First, I'd like to welcome everybody to the Second Court of Appeals. We have visitors with us today, as some of you may have gathered. We've got undergrad and law students here who are interns in several of the courts downstairs. We have students from TCU, UNT, Rice, Texas Tech Law, Baylor Law, SMU, Southern University, and TWU. We hope you enjoy your visit with us this morning. Just so you know, we did have four cases for oral argument, but now we only have three. We have two cases to be argued at 9 o'clock. We'll take a short recess, and then we'll pick up with our third case for oral argument, which will be David Cook versus State of Texas. The first two cases, though, we'll hear one after another, the first one being Burton versus Carter Blood Care. If the clerk will please announce counsel for the various parties.
May it please the court, Mr. Robert Goodman Jr. to argue for appellant, and Mr. Roy Devin and Ramon Bismeyer to argue for appellee.
Justice Dofino has reminded me that it would be perhaps prudent to introduce our visiting judge, a former justice and now retired justice who remains a visiting justice with us quite often. We have Justice Dixon Holman with us to my left, and of course Justice Leanne Dofino is to my right. All right, if we will now proceed, Mr. Goodman.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court. Summary judgment can make quick work of a case, but quick work is not necessarily good work, and it wasn't here. Summary judgment was not proper as to any of plaintiff's claims. In support of her age discrimination claim, Ms. Burton had undisputed evidence of age disparate treatment of numerous kinds. She had evidence of age bias by her immediate supervisor and by an upper-level decision-maker within Carter Blood Care. The forms of disparate treatment included being isolated, being treated differently vis-a-vis her subordinates. Her supervisor went around her in a way that she didn't with other younger subordinates. The history of her treatment, moreover, under the same supervisor lasted several years before she was terminated. So there was a established pattern of disparate treatment by her supervisor, who was not her original supervisor, at the time of her termination. The supervisor referred to anybody over 40 as old. Another upper-level decision maker had referred to a tendency, a trend at Carter Blood Care to replace older managers with younger managers. When she was terminated, she was given an entirely vague reason for her termination, disruption in her department. This was not reasonably specific in the way that the law requires. The law requires that a reason for termination to be deemed legitimate and non-discriminatory be one which, when stated, would conclusively establish that there was no discrimination. That entirely vague reason for termination justified a denial of summary judgment based on plaintiff's prima facie case alone, that she was discharged, that there was evidence of age bias in the discharge, that she was over 40, and that she was qualified for her position, all of which she presented. There was therefore no need to go further for the trial court to go further. But if the trial court wanted to treat this vague reason for termination as legitimate in some fashion, then it had direct evidence of pretext in her termination. Favorable witnesses and favorable evidence relating to her conduct as a supervisor was known to the woman, the third-party human resources consultant, who conducted this interrogation underlying her termination, but was not presented to the decision makers. Witnesses who could be favorable to her were not all addressed, either in the context of the informal interviews or afterwards. And as I'll indicate in a minute, there was a complete one-sidedness to the interrogation. No surprise that there was a complete one-sidedness in the after-action report, if I may put it that way.
Let me clarify. Are you saying there's sufficient evidence in the summary judgment record as it exists right now to support these favorable reviews or favorable aspects of her job performance?
Yes, there were admitted favorable comments about Ms. Burton made to Ms. Sorrells, the interrogator, that were never recommunicated to those who purportedly decided her fate. And the, again, although it should be sufficient because of this entirely vague reason to deny summary judgment based upon Ms. Burton's presenting her prima facie case, beyond the evidence of pretext, in connection with the termination itself, you have this circumstantial evidence of disparate treatment for several years leading up to the termination. You have the explicit evidence of bias, and those support an alternative justification for denying summary judgment, that is, that there was evidence that a jury should hear that age was a motivating factor in her termination. There was an argument made below, which the trial court in its ruling obviously didn't necessarily adopt, but which is pernicious, and this court should not adopt it. The Fifth Circuit has refused to adopt it, and it is that evidence of comparative treatment in a discrimination case must always involve reasonably identical circumstances. That is true, and there's a line of cases that's recognized in my brief where that is true for cases of disparate discipline. When somebody says, hey, I violated a rule, I paid a personal expense, I did this or that, and I got fired, but somebody else in a different protected class didn't. In those cases, the reasonably identical standard makes perfect sense, but it has not since 1964 when Title VII was enacted, or since, I believe, 1981 when the Texas Labor Code was enacted, been the standard for determining the appropriateness of evidence of disparate treatment to support a claim of bias, inferred or explicit bias in a termination or other adverse action that's being challenged under the discrimination laws. On the false imprisonment claim, plaintiff presented evidence of a fraudulently induced, hyper-aggressive interrogation calculated to leave her sputtering, and it did. She suffered panic attacks, basically a nervous breakdown for the 6 weeks following, all of which is reflected in the summary judgment record. She was forced to endure 3 hours of an aggressive interrogation in which she was referred to by Ms. Sorrells as the accused. She was accused of criminal conduct of stealing, and there was other highly defamatory statements repeated to her, never tested, and this is appropriate to mention in connection with her defamation claim, the truth of which was never tested either in the interrogation nor otherwise. She was put in a situation in which, again, she was referred to as the accused, charged with criminal conduct. The objective, not admitted by Ms. Sorrells, but evident by everything she did for 3 hours, was to force some sputtering confession at the end of it. And what actually happened at the end of it is she said, in effect, don't you want to hear anything that isn't highly negative about me? And Ms. Sorrells dismissed that with a sarcastic remark. She was never asked if she wanted to leave. Her property, her job was threatened. Her person was threatened. I've indicated the type of approach that Ms. Sorrells made to her frequently throughout the interrogation that's been admitted by Ms. Sorrells and testified to by Ms. Burton, getting very close, getting very oppressive in her manner. Her reputation was savagely attacked by the repetition of remarks that she denied. She did not deny one of them. She was credible in addressing what was said about her, but was not going to lie for the sake of getting it over. And that was essentially what was contemplated.
But isn't one of the hurdles your client has in proceeding with her case the fact that she never asked to leave or tried to leave?
By no means. The cases which I've addressed on page 34 of my brief, which they say that you have to yourself ask No, those cases involve opportunities being given and taken under circumstances where voluntariness is unquestionable. The false imprisonment cases as a whole involve these oppressive circumstances being created, which are hard to describe except in the moment. It is hard to imagine except in the moment. If I, for example, and I said this to my law clerk coming over, if I started saying to you, asked you to come to a meeting under false pretenses and started saying to you, everything in your life has been a lie, challenging you to your very core, does the phrase glued to your seat, wanting to defend yourself come to mind? That's exactly the situation we had here. And it was planned. There was a detailed outline that wasn't applied to the interviews of any of the other people who were involved here. And interestingly, there was another woman whose name kept coming up in the interviews who, frankly, and I've indicated why in the brief, really could be seen as having been a bad manager that justified termination, not someone about whom it was simply said that she said ugly things, which she denied saying. And so that's another aspect of the kangaroo court quality of the interrogation. There was another woman whose name kept coming up. Nothing was said about her at the presentation to the upper management who made the decision to terminate her. It was a very forced exercise. There was no sincere objectivity that one can assume was shown at any stage of it past her engagement to do this job. And there was a highly misleading quality to it. This was a former lawyer who had given up her bar membership, and she characterized herself as a non-practicing lawyer. That is particularly aggravating to me when a lawyer is either involved in impersonation or other misleading conduct. And that is how it started, and that's how it ended. There was, in fact, and it's recorded in the brief, some discussion of, well, this is just like cross-examination. It's not like any cross-examination I've ever had. I have not let deponents, I have asked opponents if they want to leave the room. And when they say they want to leave the room, they leave the room. That's not what happened here. There's another peculiar fact here, that is that during the course of the interrogation, at least five times, Ms. Burton said, I am terribly uncomfortable. She also referred to a prior incident in which she suffered a psychologically adverse reaction at Carter Blood Care. So Ms. Sorrells knew she had a vulnerable person she was dealing with, but didn't say anything about it, didn't do anything about it. It was a highly amateurish parody of what an aggressive interrogation should be. She was not sensitive to the person who she was interrogating, showed no insincere effort to accommodate that person, and it was an interrogation that had its natural effect in a series of panic attacks and physical effects for the following month, and to some extent beyond, but very acute in the weeks following. There was no legal basis for this. Ms. Sorrells was an independent contractor. Obviously, a storekeeper's privilege didn't apply, and an employer's privilege didn't apply because the aspects of the interrogation that I've talked about were completely unreasonable in terms of duration and manner, according to the six or seven cases that explain the limitations of the qualified employer's privilege and the qualified shopkeeper's privilege, even if the court applied those to an independent contractor. The degree of negativity and aggressiveness, the duration, and the awareness of the prior vulnerability of this plaintiff make this a false imprisonment claim, which a jury should have heard, which should not have been cut off at the pass. Intentional infliction, Your Honor, I'll just say this. The Bruce case, which the Supreme Court decided, involved outrageous conduct by a supervisor. And that was perhaps a surprise decision by the Supreme Court. But the conduct was so outrageous that, to use the Hornbook terms, it should not be tolerated in a civilized community. I think a jury should have determined whether this misleading interrogation by an ex-lawyer mischaracterizing herself should have been examined in the same fashion. And during the course of the interrogation, many defamatory statements were repeated, never tested for their truthfulness, and then repeated to management, supporting the defamation claim. I reserve my additional time.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Goodman. Mr. Diven, you're going to argue first, I understand.
Yes, Your Honor. May it please the court, I'm here on behalf of Appellee Carter Blood Care. I ask the court to affirm the summary judgment which was granted below. The trial court did not specify the grounds for the summary judgment, and we urged multiple grounds for the summary judgment below. And under established appellate law, if any grounds support the trial court's summary judgment and are meritorious, then the decision should be affirmed. In addition, the trial court below reviewed objections that we made to Ms. Burton's summary judgment evidence and sustained those objections. And in Ms. Burton's appellate brief, nowhere does she argue that those evidentiary rulings were improper. So we assert that there's been basically a briefing waiver on that point, and that Ms. Burton's objected to summary judgment evidence is not before this honorable court. And that especially includes counsel was referring to evidence of purported disparate treatment, meaning that substantially younger employees were supposedly treated different than Ms. Burton. The trial court sustained objections that we made that Ms. Burton had no personal knowledge of the ages of her coworkers and that she had no personal knowledge of their birth dates, and she admitted that in her deposition. So that evidence is not before the court.
She had no personal knowledge they were young or no personal knowledge of their exact birth date?
Well, Your Honor, the objection we made was that this was just opinion testimony, and again, on appeal, counsel for Ms. Burton has not challenged that evidentiary ruling.
What was opinion testimony? That they were younger?
Yes, Your Honor.
You mean I can't look at those students and say, figure out they're younger than I am?
Well, again, Your Honor, the position that we're asserting is that that's an evidentiary ruling that the trial court made, which, again, is not before Your Honors, of whether it's a good or a bad decision. It simply is not briefed by Ms. Burton.
So your position is there's no issue of fact and that they're precluded as a matter of law from pursuing their causes of action?
Yes, Your Honor. That's one of our positions. And as I turn to the age claim, I note that their age claim is Ms. Burton was hired when she was 52 years old, and that her position is that she was fired because she got 6.5 years older. And I think the trial judge found that to be ridiculous and merited a summary judgment. We proved that she was discharged because of the substantial employee unrest under her. In other words, for the last 3.5 years of her employment, we've submitted 10 affidavits and additionally a deposition of an ex-employee, which showed that 10 different employees complained during that time period about Ms. Burton's treatment of them. Ms. Burton does not dispute that those complaints occurred. She does not dispute that those employees' concerns were brought before management.
Was there some summary judgment evidence indicating that this was an employment at will situation?
Yes, Your Honor, there is. It's in the employee handbook. And again, because it's an employment at will situation, it's important for the court as a gatekeeper to not allow somebody just because they happen to be in the protected age group to automatically have a jury trial. If we allow that, I mean, all of us have a gender, a race, an age. If the court allows somebody who, just because they're in a protected age group, to get a jury trial, there is no employment at will anymore. And that's what this honorable court...
The constitutional provision that Texas has that allows open courts, that allows people to get jury trials, that allows the juries to make the determinations unless there is no cause of action.
Well, Your Honor, that applies when there is a material fact question. Here there is none. The appellant's own brief admits, and it's on page 32, that it's Ms. Sorrell's report to management, in other words, an independent third party who is highly trained, has done 70 employee investigations, was at the Kelly Hart Law Firm, has been an adjunct professor at Texas Wesleyan, certified in HR, that when she made her report, that's what caused the discharge. That's not age discrimination. There's no evidence Ms. Sorrell's cared about Ms. Burton's age or that she ever discussed Ms. Burton's age. Your Honors, I know that my co-appellee would like to speak too, and so I appreciate your attention to this case.
Thank you, Mr. Diven. Mr. Bismar, did I say that correctly?
Yes, ma'am, you did.
All right, thank you.
May it please the Court, Ray Bismar, the firm Cocksmith, and with Callie McGowan, we're honored to represent Susan Sorrells and Employment Practices Solutions, or EPS. I think it's particularly important as we look at this, the case that's before the court here, to actually look at the facts and not some of the, frankly, in my opinion, exaggerated opinions with respect to the facts and what happened here. I think the record is very clear that Ms. Sorrells was retained in February of 2009 to investigate a series of employee complaints that had been brought against Ms. Burton. Ms. Sorrells investigated and interviewed a number of employees, witnesses that she chose. Those interviews were all conducted in the very same room, a room that's in the Carter Blood Care's HR department, a room that, as the record is very clear, was used by Ms. Burton just a week before to interview someone. When asked in her deposition why she chose that room, she said she chose the room because it was the only place she could get some privacy. This is a room that has a window that runs 3 feet off the ground across the entire wall.
So the evidence is that Ms. Burton chose the physical location for the meeting?
No, ma'am. Ms. Burton had used that room a week before for an employee interview. Ms. Sorrells chose that particular room. But it's also important to note from the record that Ms. Burton was offered by Ms. Sorrells the chance to either have this meeting outside at lunch or to have the meeting during working hours, and she chose to have it during working hours. So, again, it was her choice. That interview was conducted in the room Ms. Burton had used a week before. This is a room that, as the record was clear, Ms. Burton, in her brief, admits at page 8, she actually sat closer to the door. Now, Mr. Goodman would have the court believe that because Ms. Sorrells didn't affirmatively say, you can leave here at any time, you can leave if you want to, we can take a break, that somehow transforms this employee interview into an interrogation. The fact is, Ms. Burton admitted in her deposition, she never once requested to take a break. She never once requested to leave the room. Ms. Burton didn't even know if the door was locked, if there was a lock on the door. Ms. Burton testified that she sat in the room because she was astute enough to realize that these were very serious complaints that had been brought against her by various employees. She wanted the opportunity to try to clear her name and respond to the allegations that had been made. Now, Mr. Goodman's taken the position that during this entire three-hour interrogation, nothing nice was ever said about Ms. Burton. This was not an employee evaluation. This was not the time or place to tell Ms. Burton what a great job she had done. This was an investigation of very serious employee complaints. Complaints, as Mr. Diven has said, had been brought by a number of people. Complaints that led some people to leave the company or transfer. Ms. Sorrells conducted this interview. Following the interview, Ms. Burton followed up with two emails asking if they were going to meet again to discuss the allegations. We believe the summary judgment ought to be affirmed because, as clear from the record below, as to the false imprisonment claim, there was no willful detention. And clearly, the interview was not conducted without Ms. Burton's consent. Now, Ms. Burton would have the court, realizing, of course, there is no evidence of a willful detention. She attempts to rely on a line of cases that suggest that where a threat has been made, that may allow you essentially to meet that first obligation. Here, the record's clear there was no threat made by Ms. Sorrells. She sat across a desk asking Ms. Burton questions, questions that Ms. Burton willingly responded to and never asked to leave. Because there was no threat, Ms. Burton then tries to water down this first element even more by saying, well, there was an implied threat. But the law is clear that a threat has to be such that would inspire in somebody a fear of injury to person, reputation, or property. There was no such implied threat here. Again, just because someone is being asked questions about allegations that were made doesn't automatically transform that employee interview into an interrogation that then eliminates the employee's consent in responding. If that were the case, no employer could ever investigate employee misdeeds unless you started the interview with, these are going to be unpleasant. If you don't want to answer these questions, that's okay. You don't have to. And by the way, if you'd like to leave at any time, you can leave too. And incidentally, if you say something bad, we won't use that against you.
Isn't that the Miranda warning?
This is not a criminal context, but yes, ma'am, it would appear to be somewhat similar to that. But even as the Supreme Court recognizes in a civil context, the right against self-incrimination doesn't even apply in a civil context, only in criminal. So here, the fact that Ms. Burton was astute enough to answer questions about very serious allegations doesn't mean she wasn't there willingly, doesn't mean she wasn't there with her own consent.
In looking at the threat issue, do we look at a reasonable person standard, or do we look at the particular plaintiff's ability or perception of any implied threat?
Well, the courts have, in Skillern and Black, and Skillern was a decision of this Fort Worth court, they identified various factors that include an employee's age, experience, size, sex. And in that case, I would say it's a case-by-case standard somewhat, but I think you also have to read into that a reasonable person standard. In this case, Ms. Burton's 58 years old, had been in a high-level management position supervising 150 to 300 employees. She knows how to handle herself in this situation. It was not Ms. Sorrell's interrogating her, and she didn't eliminate her consent by asking those questions. I think it's also important that when you look at Skillern and Black, the court gets there only because, again, there was a threat. In trying to determine whether the threat was sufficient to constitute willful detention, that's the factors they looked at. Here, there was no threat, and the record is clear. Now, I also want to reiterate what Mr.
Well, there was a threat of loss of her job.
There was no overt threat. She may say there was an implied threat, but again,
why was she there if they weren't considering sanctions because of complaints?
Well, that would be the case in, frankly, any investigation.
Right.
And as the Randall's case makes clear, when you're investigating employee misdeeds, the conversations may be unpleasant, but just because she's smart enough to realize my job may be in jeopardy doesn't mean that all of a sudden she's there unwillingly or without consent. So, and I want to also point out, I'm sorry?
Or free to leave.
Or free to leave. And in this case, she could have left at any time. She never asked the question, doesn't even know whether the door was locked, and admitted in her own brief she was actually closer to the door. So I also want to reiterate, again, as Mr. Divin said, and this is in page Roman numeral 8, footnote 1 of our brief, we note that, again, we filed a motion to strike certain summary judgment evidence filed by Ms. Burton. That motion was granted by the trial court. Those evidentiary rulings have not been challenged in this court. And Ms. Burton continues to cite in a brief certain portions of the record that the trial court struck. So, again, we'd urge that those pieces of evidence are not properly before the court. And then quickly, with respect to the intentional infliction of emotional distress claim, we believe the Supreme Court made its position very clear in the Hoffman-LaRoche-Zeltwanger case that where another cause of action exists, intentional infliction is a gap-filler tort. It was created where something really bad happened that caused someone emotional distress, severe emotional distress. Where you have another recognizable cause of action, you do not have an intentional infliction claim. Now, Ms. Burton has taken the position that this was a preemption case and that in that case, intentional infliction was preempted by the TCHRA claims. That's not the case, and the analysis of that court makes that clear. In fact, Justice Heck's opinion at page 451 of his brief says specifically that that holding is not based on any kind of preemptive effect. So we believe that the intentional infliction claim, because the gravamen of their complaint is solely related to the false imprisonment, that there is no intentional infliction claim here because plaintiff has an adequate remedy by way of the false imprisonment claim. Lastly, even if we get past the Zeltwanger decision, we believe it's clear there is no extreme or outrageous conduct. And although plaintiff would use the Supreme Court's decision in Bruce, a simple comparison of the supervisor's conduct in Bruce, the GTE Bruce case, is nothing close to the employee interview and the facts in this case.
I'm confused, ma'am. You said she has no intentional infliction claim because she has a false imprisonment claim, but she has no false imprisonment claim. Now, I'm confused.
Sure. Under the Supreme Court's decision in Zeltwanger, they say, again, intentional infliction is a gap filler. So if you have another remedy, that's your claim. And in fact, the Supreme Court's opinion is very clear that even if for some reason you don't have that underlying claim, or even if you choose not to bring that underlying claim, you still do not have an intentional infliction claim.
Because you have a claim that you don't have.
Because you have a claim that you could have asserted that you either chose not to make or for some other reason is barred. And so in this case, plaintiff's claim sounds in false imprisonment and discrimination. Now, of course, against EPS and Sorrells, that claim isn't made. So here she has a false imprisonment claim. Unfortunately, the elements of that cause of action aren't met. So as a matter of law, she's not entitled to bring it. But the Supreme Court's decision in Zeltwanger makes clear that she can't pursue her intentional infliction claim.
What about the defamation claim? I know your time's up, but if you'll kind of summarize your position in regard to breach of the confidentiality.
Actually, breach of confidentiality was not asserted against my clients. It was solely intentional infliction and false imprisonment. So I don't know if the court would like to hear from Mr. Divin on that particular issue.
Thank you.
May I approach?
I extensively cited the facts in this case because they are so gross, because they are so revealing, because of the state of mind they disclose on the part of Ms. Sorrells and others. And I urge the court in its review of this matter to reread that very carefully. You will see that the objections which Mr. Divin made are pot shots at a very large scope of facts. They are, in some cases, the angels on the head of a pin kind of an objection didn't know their birthdays. There was no denial that there were many younger supervisors and that Ms. Burton was, I think, if I recall correctly, the second oldest of the supervisors at her level. So the court can look at the extensive record, both on the age discrimination aspect of the case and the false imprisonment and other aspects of the case, and look at the objections and understand how potshot like they were and how they do not derogate from the
position that,
excuse me?
What about their position that you don't challenge the court's rulings on their objections and therefore
Your Honor,
the evidence is out?
The court was presented with an order that purported to reflect rulings which certainly did not include an oral ruling that granted the objections. It was a one-sided recitation of rulings by Mr. Divin, which the court accepted and signed. And that would allow the court to certainly treat, for purposes of form, those objections as being granted. But my point is that given the wide array of facts here, that picking off one or two does not deny the gist of the disparate treatment, more importantly, the fact of an explicit age discrimination remark by both her supervisor and an upper-level decision-maker years before about what exactly she had experienced, the trend towards younger people taking over management positions. So, and likewise, honestly, on the false imprisonment, to the extent there were objections related to that evidence, they are just ticks on a much larger animal representing the false imprisonment facts. This was a new supervisor. It was not her original supervisor. This notion that they hired her at 52 and fired her while she was still over 40 does not have any justification, logical or otherwise, when you have a new supervisor who was explicitly age biased. The remark about the independence of this third party, I think I've given the court a sense of what the evidence is that undermines this claim of independence on the part of this third party. But the Supreme Court of the United States recently ruled in the Staub case about the influence, the underlying influence of biased decision makers on even purportedly independent third parties, and it said that does not immunize the decisions of somebody like Carter Bloodcare under the circumstances that we are referring to, where even Ms. Sorrell's demonstrated age bias in her unwillingness to present any mitigating what could be objectively called mitigating information which she had in her hands to those who were deciding Ms. Burton's fate. She herself was the last thing from objective in presenting her own evidence to those in charge. The fact that Ms. Burton agreed to meet during working hours in a room she had met in before is a complete make-weight. I'm sure that there were job interviews in the star chamber. The fact that a room was used for an innocent purpose on one occasion and a malevolent purpose on another does not mean that the room somehow immunizes the occupiers from a tort. When seen in that light, Your Honor, it is a really fallacious argument. Ms. Sorrells herself admitted after significant cross-examination that this was in the nature of an interrogation. I'm surprised that the attempt is still being made to resuscitate the notion that it was an interview. The interviews of Ms. Burton's fellows were interviews. They were not aggressive. They did not get offensive. People were not treated as and referred to as the accused. They were not charged with crimes. There was a wide difference between those interviews and her interrogation.
But under your theory, wouldn't your theory virtually tie the hands of every employer who needed to investigate any kind of wrongdoing or alleged wrongdoing on the behalf of an employee?
No, because the courts make a very sharp distinction on duration. That's one point, Your Honor, and I think that's the most important point. This was 3 hours. There are a lot of cases that involve 40 minutes, the shoplifting situation, 40 minutes, 30 minutes, an hour. This involved 3 hours. Moreover, you had the person themselves evidencing uncomfortableness. Okay, this was not an actual, she was not actually being charged with a crime. Miranda warning did not apply. Five times, three times admitted by Ms. Sorrells, she indicated she was uncomfortable. You had her admitting that she was psychologically vulnerable to this kind of treatment at Carter, for heaven's sakes, at the same employer. There are many distinguishing factors, but I think the duration, Your Honor, it makes the point best in response to your question. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Goodman. Thank you, Mr. Diven and Mr. Bismeyer. We appreciate all of your arguments in your briefing today. Your case is submitted, and you all are excused.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you.